see I've got a few people online, but maybe not everyone. We've got Co-Chair Johnston, myself, Co-Chair Foster, online. I see we also have Speaker Representative Edgman. And I'm showing we've got Representative Merrick, and I think other folks might also be online. And maybe if folks can just let us know if you're online there.
I know this is.
I'm sorry.
I know it's Rep. Tilton.
Okay, Rep. Tilton, thank you. We've got. I'm sorry, who is that?
Knopf.
Oh, Knopf. Representative Knopf. Okay.
Wool.
LeBron.
LeBron and Wool. Was that Ortiz?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Is Representative Carpenter, Sullivan Leonard, or Joseph in there? Okay.
This is Andy Josephson.
Okay, Representative Josephson. Okay. With that, if anybody else is online, feel free to chime in and let us know if you're there. Today, the committee will hear a presentation from Neil Feininger, Director for the Office of Management and Budget, on the governor's plan to address the CARES Act funding. And with a number of legislators online, I'd like to ask folks could maybe please just mute their cell phones just so we can minimize the background noise. And then if we can let Mr. Feininger get through his presentation, then we'll take questions. I'd also like to note that we've got the audience with us, Senator Olson. Thanks for joining us. And so with that, Mr. Feininger, if you could put yourself on the record and take it away.
Good morning. For the record, Neil Feininger, Director, Office of Management and Budget. And today I'd like to go over the governor's plan as laid out in the revised program legislative package that we submitted earlier this week. So on my slide...
I'm sorry, Mr. Feininger. For folks who may be watching, the document that you have should be available if they go to the Alaska Legislature website. And I believe would it be, if you could just direct us to where this document might be?
Yes, thank you, Chair Foster. I have a PowerPoint that should be available on the Alaska Legislature website. For those who want to follow along, there is also the package available on the governor's website, which lists out all of the revised programs that were sent forward to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee earlier this week.
Thank you, Representative Johnston.
And yes, I think on the legislative site that folks can find that on the Finance Committee agenda today under documents.
Thank you. And so with that, please continue, Mr. Feininger.
Thank you. On slide two, there's a variety of federal legislation related to the COVID-19 response and mitigation. Primarily what we're going to talk about today is items that are under the CARES Act or the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act. However, there are two other pieces of legislation that provided other areas of support that aren't necessarily running through the state's budget, but do provide support out to communities and support out to individuals and address a lot of the more healthcare and medical-related response and mitigation to the virus. Primarily what we're talking about today is, you know, relief of some of the second-order effects and impacts of the COVID-19 outbreak. So slide three gives a real high-level summary of what is in the CARES Act. The largest portion of funding coming to the state from the CARES Act is what's called the COVID-19 Relief Fund, or the CRF. Of that, the state of Alaska has an allocation of $1.25 billion. This is the minimum allocation. information that, that goes out to states. And the Federal Treasury provided some additional guidance just earlier this week on April 22nd regarding how those funds can be spent. In that guidance, they listed six broad categories of expenditures, and this is designed to address expenditures that have occurred between March 1st, 2020 and December 30th, 2020. So really this is for expenditures that already are being incurred by, you know, municipalities, businesses, the state government, that already have started to be incurred and will continue to be incurred through the duration of this crisis. Those six broad categories that were laid out in the Treasury guidance address medical costs, so costs related to the provision of medical services, expenses at public hospitals, costs of testing, things of that nature, then also public health expenses. So these would be costs for addressing a lot of the public health outcomes, so things like the expense of quarantining individuals, making public areas safe for people to go into, costs of those nature. There's also another category is the payroll expenses for some of those individuals that are actually performing the work needed to mitigate and respond to the public health emergency, those who are actually going in and doing the work to make those public areas safe for people to enter into. There's also a category to allow expenditures related to compliance with these public health measures. So a lot of the public health measures that have been released, a lot of those, you know, governor's measures that have been released over the last several weeks do carry a cost for compliance. And so there is the ability to cover those costs that are incurred as a result of those mandates, those health mandates that have been released. There's also a category for general economic support. So this is really looking at support to small businesses, the state, local, tribal governments to support, you know, the provision of the services that they provide and to ensure that those economics of kind of second order impacts of the response, the impacts of those health mandates, that we can cover the economic impacts of those mandates. And there's also a sixth category that's a lot more general, sort of a broad category related to expenditures reasonably necessary to the function of government that also are related to COVID-19. So within those six categories, again, it's for expenditures during this time period we're in right now, from March 1st through December 30th. There's also other funding within the CARES Act beyond the CRS that's a little bit smaller amount of money, but it adds up to quite a bit. Right now, our estimate for that, those other non-CRS pots of money, is about $281 million. So those are areas in the CARES Act where direct allocations were made to very specific impacts. So that's where you see things like money coming to educational institutions, money coming into airports and transportation infrastructure, things of that nature. And so there are a lot of those more specific areas. And so the idea of the CRF is that it covers those areas that aren't specifically enumerated elsewhere in the bill and gives some broad ability and broad discretion for states and municipal governments to work through the impacts of the COVID-19 crisis.
I'd also like to recognize Representative Sullivan's mother, who joined us pretty much near the start there. Please continue.
Thank you. And moving to slide four. Slide four gives a summary in those two categories, the CRF and the other more direct grants out of the CARES Act, and where those are falling in the state's budget. And you can see on this chart, there's a column here listing RPL. So those are tying it back to that package that I mentioned earlier that was put forward to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee so that you can tie out, you know, which portions of the CARES Act tie to which of those RPLs. You'll note that some of those rows don't have RPL numbers listed. Those are areas where we have adequate authority within the state budget to already accept those federal revenues coming in. So as you're likely aware, there was appropriations in some of the bills passed during this session that gave authority to Department of Health and Social Services to receive money related to impacts of the CARES Act and to distribute those monies. There's also existing authority within the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development related to community development block grants, so an RPL wasn't required on that item. So each of these items, we have a slide later in the presentation to go into a little bit more detail on them. So as we get to those slides and as we walk through each step, I think we can have questions if there's questions on any of these specific items. With that, I will move to slide five. Slide five is an RPL related to direct municipal relief. So the CARES Act for states with municipalities greater than, with populations greater than 500,000, allocated 45% of those states' CRF money direct to those municipalities. Because Alaska doesn't have a municipality with greater than 500,000 residents, that rule, that allocation did not apply to the state. However, the suggestion, we're taking that guidance and suggestion to distribute 45% into municipalities, because really the municipalities and the smaller political subdivisions are a lot closer to where the response activities are happening, and so they're a lot more able to see how this is impacting their community, understand those impacts and understand where the money needs to be allocated in order to ensure the maximum benefit and the maximum mitigation and response to this. So we really see that as an important piece here, is ensuring that the money is going to those organizations best fit to respond to the crisis. So we've taken 45% of the CRF money and we're allocating out to communities. When we were looking at how to allocate it to communities, how to determine a distribution that would both provide enough resources for each community to know that they could start taking action to respond, and also make sure that distribution was fair and approximated the level of effort each community needed to put in. We looked at a lot of different points of data and pieces of information that the state has access to that might help guide our decision and guide our allocation. And we look through a lot of different data sets, different things that the state has, and really want to have a calculation that quantified the economic activity and the size and scope of government in a community. So we're looking at areas like retail, hospitality and tourism, regional commercial fishing, and other measures of commerce activity in order to distribute this money. Then we also wanted to combine in a distribution based on population. And so a distribution based on population, we have an existing program, the Community Assistance Program, that does a good job of distributing money based roughly on population. So we took that program and applied roughly half of this distribution through that program, and the other portion of the distribution, we use metrics within the Department of Commerce that give us information about those retail, hospitality, regional fishing, measures of commerce activity, and we applied a 75% factor to that, and then built that into this equation of distribution. So then, in order to distribute it, instead of sending one lump sum payment all at once, we chose to do three quarterly payments. The first payment we're targeting for May 1st, and that payment would be that population-based metric combined with a third of that economic activity metric. And then payments two and three would be the other thirds of that economic activity metric. So you can see the calculations listed out on the slide that gives you an idea of how we chose to distribute it. And the actual distribution, the by community distribution, is available within that RPL package that I mentioned earlier. The other aspect of this is that we wanted to have municipalities report back on how they're spending the money. I'd mentioned earlier the federal guidance that we've received, and that federal guidance does still apply to those communities that are receiving this money. So that federal guidance flows down to everybody that's spending this money needs to ensure that their expenditures are, you know, fitting to that federal guidance. We do want the communities and the municipalities, because they're so close to the impacts of COVID-19, and we want them to have that discretion to be able to spend the money as they see fit, but we also want to make sure that they're, you know, spending it within the guidance from the federal government. So having reports come back in and centralized through OMB, so then they can be made available, you know, made available to the legislature, made available, you know, to those interested parties, you know, that we think is the best mechanism to ensure that municipalities are, you know, staying on the right side of the federal guidance, but that they do still have that flexibility.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Steininger, are you okay with taking questions throughout?
Yes, I'm okay with taking questions throughout.
Okay, I think I heard Representative Sullivan Leonard first, and who is the other voice?
Representative Ortiz.
Okay, Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Quick question, if I could, just with regard to the economic stimulus assistance grants, looking at three quarterly payments, you then ask for monthly reports as opposed to quarterly reports. Was there a discussion on maybe asking for quarterly reports from local governments as opposed to monthly? Therefore, you could actually ascertain how each community is utilizing those funds then as they're coming in.
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard. That's a really great point. The money would be distributed out on a quarterly basis. However, the one reason that we are leaning towards monthly reporting is to give us more information a little bit quicker on how the money is spent so that we have a better understanding of what's happening. But we're still working with working to figure out what the best reporting mechanism is. Every municipality has, you know, a slightly different accounting system, a slightly different way of recording their expenditures. So we need to ensure that, you know, the reports are something that all municipalities can provide, and that we have a fairly standard but flexible report. But getting data monthly gives us a bit better idea, a little bit quicker of, you know, how money is being spent in communities and how this is, you know, and the effectiveness of the response activity.
Thank you. And then quick follow-up, please, Mr. Chairman.
Follow-up.
Okay. And then with regard to the related expenditures for this federal fund, what do you have then set for parameters on how the local municipalities may spend this money?
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard. The municipalities should also be, you know, looking at that federal guidance, and, you know, we're also looking at the federal guidance. We're working with our federal partners to, you know, better understand it as there's questions about, does this cost fit, does that cost fit? And those kind of questions, you know, I think everybody, since everybody's sort of responding to this at the same time, everybody has those questions, and we're getting them answered the best we can and the quickest we can. But we're definitely here, you know, as a resource to the municipalities as well, as they get this money and they start wanting to spend it, if they have costs that they think, you know, they're not quite sure, you know, do they fit into this category or that category, you know, we're definitely here to be able to provide that, you know, that help. You know, this is really a team effort, so everybody kind of needs to pitch in and help answer questions as they come up. So we're hoping that we can help those municipalities that have questions, you know, make sure that their spending is, you know, is in line and meets the federal guidance.
Okay, and I'd also like to recognize that we're joined by Representative Jackson here in the audience. Thanks for being here. Next question to Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Steininger, for being with us here this morning. Referring to specifically to slide 5 and the term down there under payment number 1 where you say 0.25 times economic activity metrics, can you tell me a little bit about what economic activity metrics means or the inputs you use to determine what those metrics are all about?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, Representative Ortiz. So the metrics that we used, we looked through what data that we have that both quantifies sort of the amount of economic activity in, you know, any given municipality, as well as sort of the government's involvement in that activity as well, so kind of the scope and scale of a local municipal government. And the Department of Commerce has a lot of data on, you know, things like retail activity, hospitality activity, you know, through hotels, tourism activity, you know, commercial fishing activity, and there are metrics that quantify all of those. And so we applied a 75% factor to those metrics, and so that's what that 0.25 is, taking a third of that 75%. So, you know, when I say a third, you know, I'm talking about a third of 75% of the total, so that's why it's 0.25, not 0.33. But so we applied that factor to those metrics that the Department of Commerce collects on an annual basis.
Follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow-up.
So I can appreciate that, but are you telling me that the department has data from all the different communities that would be receiving this money about that kind of activity?
So through the chair, Representative Ortiz, when you look at the list of communities, you can see that some of them have values within those three other columns, the columns that represent the economic activity metrics, and you know, they're somewhat variable, but the key piece there is it's representative of every community that collects that data and provides it back to Commerce, that also uses those economic activities as a means to support their local municipal government as well. So there is an element of, you know, sort of size of government within the community that's inherent in the data that we use. So some municipalities may provide a, you know, a lower level of, you know, may have a lower involvement in the community. The municipal government may have a lower level of involvement in that community, and the, you know, the government involvement may come from a different political subdivision that may sit above that community. So we wanted to make sure that the distribution went to that political subdivision most involved in the activity within that community.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. And you know, my questions are probably, you know, a result of my own ignorance here. But I guess what I'm concerned about is whether or not, you know, you'd have the accurate information to make your distribution calculation, and to make sure that distribution is as fair as possible, which I'm sure you're concerned about. So anyway, Mr. Chairman, I want to come back to this one by the time the presentation's over. Maybe things will become a little bit more clear to me once the presentation's over, but I would like to reserve the right of addressing this particular slide again if I'm not getting my answers, if I'm not understanding what I think I need to understand. So thank you very much.
Okay, and next up we've got Representative Johnson, and then LeBron, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to let Representative LeBron go before me. But a couple of questions. Thank you, Mr. Seiniger, for doing this, because it is very helpful. As far as the three tranches, and I appreciate you asking for monthly reports, because I've been looking at these federal guidelines forward and backwards and from all different angles, and I will say that at times it's as clear as mud. So I think we're all walking through this very cautiously, and because these are funds, if they're misappropriated, we're going to have to pay back. So I appreciate the 30-day reports. My question is, since you have the three tranches, are you going, is OMB going to look at those reports and see the funds expended, and like, would it be 80% of the first tranche spent before they release the second tranche, or do you have any formula to that as far as releasing the second and third tranche?
Thank you, Chair Johnston. The tranches are going to go out. The plan is to send them out, you know, regardless of the expenditures on the prior tranche. The reporting is to help us monitor how it's being spent. If a municipality doesn't spend all the money, you know, the federal guidance that came out on the 22nd did make it clear that that would be, you know, unspent monies would be returned to the Treasury. But we do still intend to, you know, distribute this money on a quarterly basis. We anticipate that the impacts of COVID are pretty significant. So we're not at this point necessarily as concerned about communities, you know, a lack of spending within a community resulting in less need for the money. We're more concerned about ensuring that that money gets there in a, you know, expeditious and reliable manner so that those communities can, you know, kind of know how much money is coming to them, can plan for that, and not be, you know, kind of making expenditures without any certainty that they'll be reimbursed.
Thank you.
Representative Levon.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The economic activity variable in this formula seems to be very subjective. I'm trying to reconcile the fact that the Fairbanks North Star Borough is allocated $450 per person and is at the bottom of the list of the bigger communities, while, for example, Kenai is at $1,150 per person, Matsu over $600 per person. It seems to me that given this is such a statewide crisis as far as economic impact, I have a hard time believing Fairbanks isn't worthy of a little bit more support than $450 per person. So I would have a problem with the subjectivity of this economic activity variable. I just can't believe that we're doing so well up here in Fairbanks that we only need to be at the bottom of that list, and we should be happy with that position. Maybe we would need another presentation to dig deeper into that variable in the formula, the economic activity, because I don't have a clue how that works. And I should understand that better. And I just want to go on record as saying I'm not happy at all about a $450 per person allocation for the Fairbanks area. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Could you have anything, Mr. Simon,
Mr. Chairman? So through the chair, Representative LeBond, you know, I think that's a very good point that you brought up. There's part of the way that, you know, the economic variables, as I was saying earlier, they also kind of inherently in their nature of how they're collected, to a certain extent, indicate the, you know, the size of a particular political subdivision's involvement in the community. So there are, you know, I think everybody is pretty aware, you know, the cost of providing government services in the various areas of the state can be pretty highly variable on a per capita basis. You know, some rural areas of Alaska are much more expensive to provide services than others. And so the data that we used has some of that, you know, that kind of geographic variability baked into it, and has a bit of that, you know, the municipal or the political subdivision involvement in activity in the community baked into it. And so that's where you see some of that, you know, disparity between communities, and, you know, also just the, you know, on the objectivity versus subjectivity of the distribution. We tried to use a calculation that was as, you know, objective as we could with the data that the state has. So it really, there's some limitation to, you know, what data is available to the state, what data is available for us to estimate the impacts and to make a distribution so that communities can, as soon as possible, have some certainty in the amount of relief coming their way so that they can then, you know, plan their mitigation efforts, you know, around that certainty. So really it was, you know, the data that we have, trying to adjust for, you know, a lot of those factors surrounding economic activity and, you know, various size of government in each community.
Yeah, follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow-up?
Yes, thank you. That really doesn't address my concerns. The most impactful part of that formula should be population. That should dominate the allocation. I think if you ask all communities in the state to address their economic impact, there'd be no question we're all severely economically impacted. And to split hairs on that part of the formula is a disservice. And I wish we could readdress this whole issue and look at population as being the dominant part of this formula. I just cannot believe, again, that Fairbanks would be so far down on that list if a true economic impact analysis was conducted on this. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I have a follow-up question as well.
I think I heard, was that Representative Wohl that I heard a few moments ago first?
Yes, I did. Representative Knopf, okay. Mr. Chairman.
Okay, so I've got in the queue Representative Wohl, then Representative Ortiz and Knopf. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, on the same subject, it sounds like of the money allocated from munis, half of it goes by the community assistance formula, and the other half goes by the economic metrics. Community assistance formula I'm fairly familiar with. They give a flat amount to a borough, a different flat amount to a city, a different flat amount to an unorganized inside a borough, and a different amount to an unorganized outside of a borough. So I'm assuming you followed those formulas. And then the remainder with a community assistance gets divvied up per capita throughout the whole state. So the larger areas get more money because they have more people, but the smaller areas might get more based on their organizing entity. So I'm assuming you did something like that. And then the other half of the money, you're saying, goes out as economic metrics of 25% in the first payment, 25% in the second payment, 25% in the third payment, which you're describing as making up the whole when really it's a quarter times three. So I'm curious whether how you've got the fourth 25%, unless you're calling that the community assistance portion, but that is half of the $460 million. Secondly, is there a formula for the economic metrics, like there's a formula for community assistance? And if so, obviously some people are asking a lot of questions about it. Can you give us the formula so that it isn't looking subjective, that it's objective with a formula based on how many nights in a how many bed nights they have or how many fish, tons of fish they've landed, et cetera, et cetera. So, A, do you have an actual formula? And, B, do the unorganized areas also get economic metrics depending on which ones they are?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, thank you for the description of the community assistance program. That is, you know, that is the way that that portion of the distribution was calculated was, you know, we used the existing community assistance spreadsheet that is used annually to distribute that money. So that is the kind of standard known process, just with a much, you know, larger amount of money runs through that same formula. And it does go out, you know, the portion beyond the base, the community assistance program base amount, you know, the portion beyond that does go, you know, primarily based on population out throughout the state. So that kind of half roughly of our overall CRF distribution is based on population. The data that Commerce has, individually walk people through that data so it's, you know, understood a little bit better. It is, you know, objective data that's collected from any, you know, any political subdivision that provides it to Commerce. So any place where those economic activity metrics impact the municipality or the city's, you know, ability to provide government services to its population is collected by the Department of Commerce. So, you know, it does touch on just about every community in Alaska, not quite all of them, as you'll see on that, you know, that distribution sheet, but that's why that, you know, population distribution for the other half is also so important. Regarding the, you know, the calculation of 0.25, you know, three times doesn't add up to 100%. When we are looking at those metrics and, you know, kind of the absolute value of them, we determine that, you know, roughly, you know, trying to get it to roughly half population and half economic activity, 75% of the absolute value of those metrics roughly got us to half of the CRF. So that's how we landed on that amount. That way we got a fairly even split and a fairly even weighting between population and then the metric that looks at economic activity and has baked in, like I was saying earlier, some level of size of political subdivision.
Thank you. Follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
So if 0.25 of economic activity equals roughly half of the grant, then the other the community assistance portion, that would be the other half, which would be half of 560. Is that I'm sorry, not 560. Yeah, is that half of 560, so 280, basically goes out under the community assistance formula? And if so, are all the political organized entities getting their per capita? In other words, you know, an unorganized inside a borough gets, I think, 1/19th what a full borough gets, like 300,000, 1/19th of that, or one gets 1/12th, I think 25,000 for unorganized outside a borough. Do they also get some of that? You're saying if they don't submit the economic activity, they don't get that portion. But are they getting the per capita portion as well, same as the economic community assistance formula?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, yes. So anyone that was part of the community, the most recent community assistance program, any political subdivision part of that most recent community assistance program distribution is also part of this distribution. And regarding the rough half population, half economic development, it's not exactly half, it's roughly half. The 75% got through roughly 50%. So it's 305 million of the 562.5 is going out based on those economic activity metrics. And the remaining 257.5 million goes out based on the community assistance formula. And that was because the 75% of those, the absolute value of those metrics gets us to roughly half, which is at 305 million. So it's not a perfect 50-50 split, but it's close.
I'd be interested in see whatever formula calculations you guys used for the economic metrics.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Next question, Representative Ortiz, and then Representative Knopf. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess as a follow-up of some of the questions that we've been hearing from Representative Laban and Wolf, maybe to put it a different way, Mr. Steininger, can you explain why under the inputs that you used and under the formula that you used, why UNO would qualify for 10 times the amount that Fairbanks qualifies for, and why North Slope doesn't get anything? It looks like they get zero. So if that can be explained, or maybe would the absolute, you know, the methodology that was actually used, could that be published so that we could all see specifically the methodology that was used to create this formula?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, you know, the distribution, you know, we're working through distribution that's trying to be as objective as possible, but it's also, you know, with the information that's available to the state, nothing's going to be, you know, perfect, and the amount of effort that it would take to get a perfect distribution would be, you know, pretty arduous and would really slow down our ability to respond and our ability to get money into the communities. You know, when we looked at the economic metrics, yes, not every community has those equally, but that's why it's also important to layer in the population metric to ensure that, you know, there's also distribution there. So a lot of the variability you see is sort of based on data that the state has and the ability to have an objective metric where it's not, you know, sort of picking and choosing subjectively. And we'd be happy to, you know, walk you through individually, you know, how that is calculated for your individual community.
Representative Ortiz, do you have a follow-up? Representative Knopf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Steininger, thanks for being with us today. I'm looking at slide number 4, and obviously, Mr. Steininger, you can see that there's some concerns about the allocation methodology used, and I appreciate the fact you had to have something to go with and you used what we currently have in place. But on that note, I was also pleased to see that you are requiring monthly reporting and quarterly distributions in regards to the CARES Act distribution and the direct municipal relief portion. So some questions and some statements in here, Mr. Steininger. First is what I've heard from some municipal managers, because of the federal guidance on what the money can be used for, that there's no way that most of these municipalities will be able to expend that money and it will end up resulting in being repaid to the federal government. So question number one is can some of that, as you progress through this quarterly in the reports, can some of that money be reallocated? Can we change this formula more on a needs base as we go forward and we are seeing which communities can expend it? Because it's strictly COVID-related issues, and every community responded differently to that. So if it's not expended, so in the case of Kenai versus Fairbanks North Star Borough, if they expend so much more and we're unable to do so, can some of them funds, as we progress, be reallocated when you get into the second and third phase of payments, number one? And second, and then part of that question is if all this money allocated to the COVID response can't be used for directly COVID-related costs, can some of it be reallocated to the Small Business Relief Fund? Because really we fell a little short in support for small businesses. And I say that, Mr. Steininger, because the Payroll Protection Plan did a lot to support employees and helping employers keep them on the payroll, but it did very little to actually business owners who either kept them on the payroll and took that money out of savings or borrowed money to keep them on, and didn't account for any losses that small businesses, I mean, there's no lost revenue makeup, as there is not to municipalities in that COVID relief funding. So, I mean, two of the things I think the legislature still needs to advocate for on behalf of businesses is the fact that in communities, you know, as a Kenai, very heavily dependent on tourism, and I think we're going to take a severe hit and lost revenue in the next year, maybe two, in that regard. So I see the revenue makeup is prohibited in the guidance issued from the Treasury. So I think that's an issue. And in the Payroll Protection Plan, those, you know, so the crisis kind of shut us down on March 1, and funding didn't really hit us until mid-April to support that. But none of that's retroactive. So all the businesses are really whatever they kept employees on and lost revenue is not made up. So really the question is, obviously I stated a couple things we need to advocate for, but the question is, as you go through this, are we able to reallocate, instead of paying it back, can we use it where it's needed, if that should arise?
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Knopp. You know, as you touched on, you know, making up lost revenue is explicitly prohibited in the Treasury guidance. However, the one statement that you may relate it to, you know, when the money gets there and the expenditures, the CARES Act does state that this money is meant to reimburse expenditures from March 1st forward. So it's our understanding that, you know, expenditures that people have already incurred, once this money is available, you know, and we can start distributing the money, you know, hopefully soon, they can, you know, reallocate from where they had expended prior to meet the immediate need. So that there is some ability to do that, to look back to March 1st in terms of expenditures that were incurred related to COVID and, you know, apply this CARES Act distribution to those expenditures. Regarding redistribution from one piece of this plan to another, the way that the, you know, the RPLs are laid out wouldn't really allow much redistribution. However, really looking at the amount of money that we've allocated for small business relief, we believe that that is a, you know, a good amount of money based on the total bucket of resources that we have and the other programs that exist to help those small businesses. Reallocating within the municipal relief program, you know, I think as we go forward, this is, you know, everything is somewhat of a, you know, a moving target. We provided this RPL package on the 21st, and then on the 22nd, we got additional guidance from the federal government on how it can be spent, you know, and there will be more guidance coming at later dates, you know, as people, you know, ask questions and the Treasury responds to those. They may slightly change how, you know, how the money can be used. There may be subsequent legislation from the federal government. So really, you know, part of the quarterly payments, you know, does give us that, you know, ability to look at if there's new information coming in from the federal government that changes the nature of this money or of the response that, you know, we do want to, you know, be able to be responsive to that. So, you know, I think there is, there needs to be flexibility inherent in how we respond because there is going to be change in, you know, how this money comes to us, you know, from the federal government and different guidance that we'll get.
Thank you, Mr. Steininger. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you. And Mr. Steininger, please proceed.
Okay. So moving on to slide six. So slide six is our small business relief plan. We've allocated $300 million out of the CRF funding to small business relief. So the way that we envision this money working has changed slightly. Like I said, we released this package on the 21st, and then additional federal guidance came out on the 22nd, which slightly changed the way that we, you know, would plan to spend this money. You know, originally, if you look at that RPL at the write-up, we're discussing the concept of, you know, loan relief to some of these small businesses. However, the federal guidance that we've gotten, you know, is a lot more tailored towards grants to small businesses. So what we're looking at is working with the various agencies around the state that are part of the state, such as, you know, HFC, the investment section within Commerce, the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, various agencies within the state that have access to different industries in the state, to look at, you know, the business community and distribute funds to businesses that don't really have the option or aren't good fits for the other existing programs, such as the Small Business Administration loans or the Payroll Protection Act that Representative Knopp touched on. You know, so we need to work this program within that federal guidance that we've received, and you'll be, you know, this one is a little more flexible in that we need to kind of respond to the guidance and make sure that the money is allocated, to the right sectors, to the right businesses that are most in need of relief. So really, it's a set aside of $300 million that we know will be needed to provide relief to those businesses, but there's not a specific allocation quite like the way that we have the municipal allocation on the prior slide, where we have a lot of specificity there. This is a little more open-ended that we need to work with the business community and different partners to make sure that this gets to the right businesses in the right way.
I had a question from Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Steininger, so what I'm hearing that this RPL is still a work in progress, is that accurate?
Chair Johnson, I would say so. I think there is room for flexibility in, exactly how we spend this money, but we do know we need a significant amount of money allocated towards small business relief.
And just a follow-up question, because I kind of trying to think historically here, this right currently, and I understand the problems, as I said before, with the guidance and how they came out the 22nd. But the right now you're having this go to the investment section of the Commerce and Community and Economic Development, indeed. And in the past, I don't ever remember having that department have passed through funds to things like ADA and AHFC. I think they have tended to have their own appropriations. So I guess I'm looking forward to seeing how you further develop this and still understanding the need.
Okay. Mr. Steininger?
Question, please, Mr. Chairman.
Representative LeBron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just curious, on slide 6, you identify AHFC, ADA, and the investment section of Commerce as the recipients of these dollars. How will the banking community interface with those agencies? Is there going to be a program to allow the banking community to have at least part of the say in how these monies are distributed among the business community?
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, that's a great suggestion. Right now, like I was touching on earlier, this plan is a little more fluid than say the specific allocation and the municipal relief portion. The idea and the federal guidance that we've received on the 22nd doesn't really allow loans, but that doesn't necessarily preclude us from working with the banking community to understand impacts to the wider business community throughout the state.
A follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow-up?
Yeah, and I would suggest if you intend to work with the banking community that you address the size of the various banks. Do not make this a first-come, first-serve, but if you allow the banking community to participate, do it on a prorated basis so the smaller banks don't get squeezed out by the larger banks. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Steininger?
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wolf?
So if I'm a small business looking for relief and I see AHFC, ADA, and Deed, and I don't necessarily do business with any of them, would I know which one to approach, and are they $300 million? Are they each getting $100 million? And maybe you don't know the answers to these, but I know businesses have a relationship with a lot of banks, and so often they're going to their bank that they currently do business with. But these other entities, and you're saying these wouldn't be loans; they'd be grants. So would businesses just apply for grants to any and all of these entities?
Through the chair, Representative Wool. So I think we'll need to have more, outreach as we develop how businesses will access it. to be able to provide, you know, more information so that, you know, those businesses know where to go to get access to the relief if they're not eligible for things like the Small Business Administration loans and the other relief that is directed towards businesses through other areas of the CARES Act and other federal legislation. But, you know, outreach will definitely need to happen prior to distribution of the money just so that we can ensure that, you know, all the businesses in the state that are seeing some pretty significant impacts know where to go and who to talk to.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Andy Josephson.
President Josephson.
Through the chair, Mr. Steininger, will the administration be using its economic stabilization team, Governor Parnell and Senator Begich, for further guidance on this component of the total package?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, you know, I say that, you know, we're using pretty much every resource that we have in the state to guide each aspect, so there's no reason we wouldn't tap on any resource within the state that has expertise in, you know, in each area of the response.
Follow-up, or not a follow-up to my own question, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Ortiz.
So, Mr. Steininger, in relationship to the last question, are you saying that the economic team has had input on this particular portion of the plan on the $300 million, or that you're not opposed to seeking that output in the future, or seeking that input in the future?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, when saying that this plan, you know, like I said, the guidance that came out after this plan was put out, after this RPL was put forward, changed somewhat how we go forward with the small business relief. So, you know, specifics are a little bit, you know, have changed a little bit, and we need to sort of move forward on making this fit with the revised federal guidance. So, you know, insofar as who we would engage with to do that, you know, we're going to work with any resources that we have available that can include that economic stabilization.
Yeah,
so at this point, a follow-up, Mr. Chairman, so at this point, the Economic Stabilization Team has not had input on this particular portion of the plan. Is that correct?
Through the chair, what I'm saying is that this portion of the plan has shifted since it was released because the federal guidance has changed it. So we don't really have, you know, beyond making sure that we work with the business community to make these grants to the entities most in need, we don't have a specific, you know, a specific plan that, you know, would have had input at this point. You know, we're working with responding to that change in federal guidance at this point.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to recognize Representative Carpenter as being online, and who is that?
Rep. Wohl won the question.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this says small business relief. So does that mean that it's for existing entities that are needing relief from what they do? It wouldn't be to provide grants to, say, a future business proposal to serve based on COVID-19 effects. So if I want to start up something, I want, or and say, hey, I have a proposal to, you know, produce masks or something like that. This is only for existing businesses. And part two of my question is, speaking of economic development teams, is the other team that was under BCCED, the Bob Penny team, is that involved in any of this?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, you're right in that this isn't for new business entities. This is to, you know, mitigate impacts to existing businesses that are suffering due to COVID-19. So if somebody were looking to start a new business to, you know, make masks. That wouldn't necessarily qualify for this. However, you know, there's other money within the CARES Act for, you know, purchase of masks. So there might be, you know, opportunities for, you know, an enterprising individual who wanted to start a business to produce masks, to sell masks. We do have the ability to buy them. But it wouldn't be, you know, direct support to that business. You know, it's not, this is intended more for businesses that are impacted, you know, your restaurant that had to shut down, your, you know, hairdresser that had to shut down due to health mandates. You know, it's to help those types of businesses that are suffering due to these, due to the economic, you know, second order impacts of the health mandates. And then regarding where this is within the Department of Commerce, we've centralized in the Department of Commerce because there are multiple entities throughout the state government, you know, like we had listed HSC, ADA, the investment section, that all, you know, have relationships with the business community. So we want to centralize it within Department of Commerce so that it's in one central spot and then can be distributed to those different agencies as need arises.
Mr. Steininger?
Okay. So slide 7 is related to economic stimulus for Alaska fisheries. So this portion is not a portion out of the CRF, but is a direct grant within the CARES Act related to fisheries relief for subsistence, charter fisheries, and commercial fishery participants. The total amount at the federal level, at the nationwide level, is $300 million for that relief package. We're estimating about $100 million would come to Alaskan fisheries based on, you know, Alaska fisheries making up about two-thirds of the tonnage value of fish catchment in the country and about one-third of the actual value, and we're looking to have the state involved in the distribution of this money so that we can make sure it goes into the correct fisheries. So the amount is estimated based on that, about a third of that $300 million national distribution.
Got a question, Representative Johnson?
Yes, through the chair, Mr. Steininger. So this is still in negotiation with the National Fisheries and Marine Service. Is that correct?
Chair Johnson, yes, that's correct.
And as far as the state allocation, was the CARES Act, did the CARES Act clarify that it was supposed to go to the discretion of the states, or is it something that we're still, as I say, in negotiations with the National Marine Service, Fisheries Marine Services, as far as who gets what and how it's, who's responsible for it?
Yes. Chair Johnson, that's correct. We're still working through who's responsible. We know that fisheries managers have reached out and are interested in the money coming through the state for distribution, so that we can ensure that the money, you know, is going to the fisheries most impacted. But that is still a conversation that's happening at the federal level to, you know, have that come through the state. So this RPL is to ensure that, you know, when that conversation happens, if the money comes through the state, we have the ability to collect and distribute it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, a question from Rep. Josephson.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Mr. Steininger, could these monies be used for a community like King Salmon Naknek to set up temporary hospital or contract with ANPs or PAs to come in for screening of workers and that sort of thing? And the reason I ask is, Assuming that's done well and the quarantining were to work and the state were to support a regular fishery, well, a a further assumption would be that there's someone on the other side of the Pacific that is prepared to buy our product. But you could see a scenario where there may not be significant financial loss. That is, if you had a full season, you might have a productive financial season. But yet there'd be these other costs associated with screening, treatment, and the like. Could that be used in that way?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I think there's other areas within the CARES Act that might be better tailored towards things like those public health, you know, setting up quarantine sites, setting up those types of screening and testing, and that type of activity fits a little bit more within those, you know, municipal distributions out of the CRF. You know, I think those costs might be a little more aligned there, whereas this money appears much more intended to go as relief to the individual impacted fisher people. So it's not necessarily for that, you know, kind of a first order public health portion of the response where you would set up, you know, a camp or a quarantine facility or a testing facility. You know, that would better fit under the activity being directed, you know, through public health or through, you know, some of that money going through municipal relief.
Okay, just a follow-up comment, and that is that it's hard to separate these things at some point. I mean, if the workers aren't safe, they can't work. And so, I mean, I take your point. You don't write the rules, but I just wanted to make that comment.
Mr. Steininger?
So moving to slide 8, unless are there any other questions on slide 7?
Mr. Chairman, I do have a question on slide 7.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Steininger, in relationship to the previous question, so this $100 million then you described would be going to the various entities that would be most impacted. Are you saying impacted by the economic impact of the virus itself in terms of market for their product, or how do you, can you describe a little bit more about how you think these funds could be used based on the impact of COVID?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I don't necessarily want to speculate too much as to, you know, exactly what type of impact to an individual fishery would be covered under this. My understanding is it is generally designed to be relief direct to the individual fisher involved in a subsistence charter or commercial fishery. And that's about the limit, I think, of the, you know, I don't want to speculate any further in terms of exactly what the circumstances surrounding, you know, what that impact is. But it is, you know, my understanding on it is intended, you know, for those individuals that are impacted, where, you know, the other types of activities like what, you know, Representative Josephson had talked about, where those things aren't necessarily going to be, you know, 100% successful in making sure every fishery can occur and that every fishery has a market. So, you know, I think there will be a lot of fisheries impacted, and this money is intended to help those individuals.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, one quick question on this slide.
Sure, Representative Levon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is the intent on these dollars to benefit Alaska fisheries and not fishery operations that come up into Alaska waters from, say, Seattle?
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, I believe the intent is to, you know, work with those fisheries that are Alaska fisheries, that are, you know, Alaska fishermen, Alaska fisherwomen, Alaskan fisheries, and those that, you know, make their livelihoods through commercial charter and subsistence fishing in Alaska.
I'm glad to hear that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Steininger?
Mm-hmm. So moving to slide 8. So this is also a distribution of the CRS money, the $1.25 billion allocation to Alaska. It's $337.5 million, and a portion of this is intended for health-related costs in DHSS, as well as a portion is just contingency, since there are so many, you know, unknowns as to where this virus progresses into the future. You know, it's prudent to set aside a large amount of that CRF money to ensure that there is a pot of money to address those, you know, future health costs and, you know, future costs that health and social services will incur in responding to the virus. So this also would be, you know, used to backfill some of the expenditures we've made out of general fund in advance of federal relief packages coming in. There isn't an RPL required for this, as there's existing authority within the Department of Health and Social Services, Division of Public Health, to collect any federal receipts related to health response from the federal government. So that's why you won't see an associated RPL document in the LBNA package.
Mr. Chairman, Andy Josephson again.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Mr. Steininger, and you sort of touched on this, but the legislature at the end of March appropriated, looks like $87.7 million toward COVID relief. Minority part of that was vetoed, but $75 million wasn't. So what is the, how would the department, would it first grab from this federal money, or would it first grab from our appropriation? And if it first took the federal money and didn't need our appropriation, would that money lapse back?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the idea is that we would first, for eligible expenses, first utilize the federal revenues. So in any situation where we're able to utilize federal revenues and there's federal revenues available, you know, that is definitely the preferable option. You know, for those things that maybe don't fit the guidance of the federal revenues that we've received, that amount of general funds provides us the ability to still meet those needs. But yes, if that amount isn't spent on the health crisis and, you know, isn't needed and we receive adequate federal revenues to cover all the different various costs related to COVID, then yes, it would be lapsed back into the general fund after the appropriation expires.
Thank you.
Mr. Steininger?
Moving to slide 9. So this is a $50 million amount allocated for support to nonprofits. So these would be human services nonprofits, so groups that are operating soup kitchens, food banks, homeless shelters, and providing clothing to individuals that are displaced and impacted due to COVID. It's allocated to DHSS, also utilizing that federal receipt authority within the Division of Public Health. And the idea is to run this through the existing community initiative and human services matching grant programs, so that because those programs already exist to provide grants out to these types of organizations. And so, as everyone's aware, there's a lot of these organizations out there providing support for, you know, homeless populations that, you know, are displaced due to COVID, and, you know, individuals who may have lost their jobs and things of that nature. So this is to ensure that nonprofit community within the state has access to resources to, you know, continue that support that they provide.
Mr. Chairman, question.
Representative LeBron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just so I'm clear on this, the distribution would include city and borough governments, and they would have a role in how these grants are distributed?
Through the chair, Representative LeBron, the idea here is that the grants go directly to the nonprofits. So the existing program within Health and Social Services provides grants directly to these nonprofits. So we're looking at, you know, bolstering that existing program with the additional federal revenues so that we can provide enough grants to all of those nonprofits. But it wouldn't run through the local municipality. It would run through the state program.
A follow-up, please.
Follow-up?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, so the judgment would be on the part of the state as to how that distribution is made.
Through the chair, Representative LeBron, that's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chair, I have a question.
Representative Wolf.
Is there any reporting requirement for the nonprofits, such as there is for municipalities on some of the money that they get?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, I'm not perfectly familiar with the reporting requirements in the existing program. However, you know, just like with the municipalities, these nonprofits would need to spend the money on eligible expenditures under the federal guidance. The idea is that we're targeting these monies towards nonprofits that already are out there and doing work related to COVID. So, you know, pretty much any homeless shelter or soup kitchen in the state has had to respond pretty dramatically to, you know, ensure some of these health mandates are being followed, like the social distancing rules and things of that nature, and it's, you know, pretty significant cost for those organizations. So we don't think there's going to be trouble in being able to tie costs within those nonprofits to COVID. I don't think there will be much issue in tying it back to that federal guidance, because it's pretty clearly laid out that things like this are allowable.
Thank you.
Mr. Steininger?
Thank you. Moving on to slide 10. This is a $5 million grant for child nutrition within the Department of Education and Early Development. So there's a specific allocation within the CARES Act specifically for child nutrition and the provision of, you know, meals to students.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Ortiz.
So Mr. Steininger, the figure $5 million, how was that arrived at? Why was that decided as the amount that was needed?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, $5 million represents the amount that's allocated to Alaska through the CARES Act, through the distribution determined by the federal government.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Steininger?
Thank you. Slide 11, the CARES Act includes money for community development block grants that runs through the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. There's $2.8 million allocated to Alaska within the CARES Act. There's already some existing federal authority within prior Department of Commerce appropriations for the community development block grants, just some excess federal authority that's out there, which will then be utilized to collect on these revenues and distribute the block grants out to communities.
Chair, I have a question.
Representative Wolf.
Yeah, is this what was the amount that was vetoed to this for these block grants?
Through the chair, Representative Wolf, I don't have that number off the top of my head.
Okay, I guess I was just wondering if this is a backfill of the vetoes for the community development block grant.
Through the chair, Representative Wolf, this $2.8 million represents a direct allocation to Alaska from the federal government through the CARES Act.
Thank you.
Mr. Steininger?
Moving on to slide 12. This is $48 million for emergency education relief funds allocated to the Department of Education and Early Development. This represents the amounts directly allocated to Alaska in the CARES Act, $38.4 million of which is for education stabilization. These are grants that are distributed out to local education agencies or the school districts through the Title I formula. In addition, there's $6.5 million in what's called the Governor's Emergency Education Relief Fund. That was a fund set up in the CARES Act to allow states discretion in providing grants to school districts and other education agencies based on need and impacts of COVID. The number, the total $48 million number, is slightly rounded up because our distribution under the CARES Act for these purposes, and we believe this is the amount we get, but there is some opportunity to receive slightly more. So that number is, the number that's being requested in the RPL is slightly higher than the allocation that we know today.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Ortiz?
So Mr. Steiniger, so the $48 million then, will that entire amount be distributed through the formula program or just the 38.4? And then what? How would the 6.5 be distributed to the school?
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, the 38.4, 90% of that is required to be distributed through the Title I allocation. The department can provide a list that shows, you know, how much each school district gets. And then the $6.5 million amount can be distributed with, you know, the discretion of the department to meet, you know, the most impacted districts. The distribution that the department has right now, they have determined about half of that, and you can see that on a list that they can provide that shows which districts. The remaining 10% within the 38.4, that can be used for other COVID-related costs through the provision of education with, that the department is incurring. So things like helping districts for stuff like distance learning. So it allows for some resources to be available at the state level to assist in some of those programs and in some of those other impacts that maybe some state coordination can help with. The remaining half of the $6.5 million that hasn't been determined for distribution yet, just hasn't been determined yet. So there's not, you know, we're holding that in reserve, you know, to look for areas where there might be districts that are seeing a larger impact than others.
So,
Mr.
Follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Ortiz?
So as to the 6.5 million or the remaining half of the 6.5 million, would it then be up to the individual district to make the case that they have been most impacted by the COVID situation in their particular district to qualify for these funds?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, the discretion for how that gets distributed, you know, sits with, you know, the governor and the Department of Education. So I think they are working through trying to determine how, you know, what the best way to distribute that money is, what the best way to determine which districts are most impacted, because as we all know, all the districts are being impacted by COVID. So they're trying to determine what the best mechanism would be to distribute that remaining half. And it just it hasn't been determined yet, and it's being held in reserve because, you know, like the reserve being held in health and social services, you know, there's a lot of unknowns about how these impacts will carry forward.
Thank you.
Mr. Stanley?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Josephson?
Yes. Through the chair, Mr. Steininger, the $562 million for local governments, was it within the administration's authority to give monies directly to the 54 school districts?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the 45% of the CRF, the 562.5, are understanding of the guidance related to the CARES Act is that that should be distributed to municipalities, and then so those, you know, those municipalities, those other political subdivisions that we've distributed to, you know, if they have a district within, you know, within that subdivision that has seen impacts related to COVID that maybe can't be covered under this, you know, $38 million distribution, you know, it's within their discretion then to allocate that money. So that provides those, you know, those cities and those areas with the most discretion. So if they're seeing that, you know, the biggest and most clear need within their community is, you know, helping out a school, then they have that ability to do so. We didn't want to tie their hands and dictate too much how that money is spent, just simply give them all the discretion available within the guidance we have from the Treasury.
A follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow-up.
Linked to my previous question, but broadening it a bit, a number of the governors around the country are complaining, and I have my own concerns about drawing up additional $2.5 trillion into our federal deficit for great grandchildren, I guess, to pay. So setting that huge concern aside, a number of our sister states are making the argument that Congress has failed to bail them out, and there's been this odd discussion about bankruptcy. New York, for example, has a $15 billion deficit. We're a horrible candidate for bankruptcy for obvious reasons. But I'm only laying out that context because it relates to my question about school districts in this respect. Is the administration going to join in the outcry for funds that are not necessarily directly COVID-related? I'll give you an example. Obviously, the oil recession is impacting our bottom line significantly, and that is sort of directly related to COVID. So I guess what I'm wondering is, will the administration be joining governors like Governor Cuomo asking for additional funding for direct aid?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I don't know if I can speculate as to what, you know, future intentions are for, you know, joining into any of those sorts of petitions. You know, the more flexible that this money is, the better impact it will have for, you know, helping Alaska recover from all of the first and second order impacts of COVID-19. But, you know, right now we have to work within the guidance that the Treasury has provided us, and that doesn't allow for, you know, backfill of lost revenues or things of that nature.
Okay, thank you.
Please proceed, Mr. Seniger.
Okay. On to slide 13. So this is $5 million for the Higher Education Emergency Relief Fund. So this is a fund that was set up in the CARES Act to provide relief to higher education institutions. Of that fund overall, $7.9 million goes to the University of Alaska system. The university system has some existing federal authority that they're able to use to collect a portion of that, and that is why this RPL is only for $5 million. It's for the difference of the shortfall in their federal receipt authority. Half of that is for grants directly to students, and then the other half is used with a little bit more discretion by the institution.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Representative Wolf.
So this $5 million, was that a federal determination or is that a state request? Secondly, you're saying UA has federal authority to cover part of the grant. So it looks like the relief fund is $5 million. UA will get $7.9 million. And I guess that's other grant monies coming in. I guess I'm a little confused. And also, grants directly to students. I'm aware of the students are
are being sent home to do what is the – how are they determining the students' requirements? And I know the university had a publication saying they could be affected to the tune of $20 million from COVID. That was a little while ago. So I didn't know if the administration was looking to address some of that information.
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, so the $7.9 million allocation to University of Alaska was determined by the federal government. So that wasn't a, you know, that's not a state determination, but it's what the amount allocated to that university system is by the federal government. The difference between that and the $5 million is just the additional amount of receipt authority that they need. So they already have what's called generally excess federal authority, or you know, sometimes called hollow federal authority within their budget. That allows them to make up about $3 million of that, which is why they only need an additional five. But they will be getting $7.9 million total from the federal government to cover some of the impacts related to COVID. And then regarding the determination of the money directly to students versus the money to the university, that also is something that was laid out specifically in the CARES Act. So that's a piece of it that we don't have the discretion over. It's, you know, sort of a dictated use of the – this is a direct grant within the CARES Act.
Thank you. Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up?
Yeah, is there any plans for the administration to
grill these guys all the time? So.
Directed to the university as they are impacted by COVID, obviously by probably lack of declining enrollment, people not necessarily wanting to do distance-only education, so on and so forth, like other industries that are affected at the university. On the plan horizon for the administration to receive any more COVID money, federal money directed from the state.
Excuse me, I think somebody maybe have taken their phone off mute. And I'm not sure, Mr. Steininger, did you get Representative Wohl's question?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, I think I'll try and restate the question just because there was some interference there in terms of hearing it. But it sounds like what you're asking is what is or is there a plan to address, you know, continued future impacts to the university system as a result of COVID and, you know, decisions made by students as to whether they choose to do on-campus versus remote learning in the future. Is that an accurate restatement?
Yeah, basically, like fishing industry, like hospitality industry, universities affected. They're getting 7.9 in federal grants. I believe half of that has to go to students. So of that, they get less than $4 million. They put out a publication earlier a month or so ago that said they could be affected to the tune of $20 million, and who knows if, what the real number is going to be. So I was just curious, is there other plans for higher education relief from the state via the federal government to the university?
Thank you for the question, Representative Wohl. So we are tracking, you know, not just with the university, but with all other state agencies as they see sort of, you know, decision-based changes in the revenue that comes in. So we've been tracking all of those types of impacts, and the university definitely is projecting a lot of impacts as a result of COVID and a result of sort of the, you know, decisions being made by students. We also see it in, you know, areas like fish and game and decisions made by people coming up for hunts. Right now, nothing in the CARES Act allows us to backfill those lost revenues. but we are still tracking them for an understanding of, you know, what relief might be necessary for state agencies that are suffering from some of those, you know, sort of decisions that other people are making in response to COVID that impacts their ability to operate. And it's certainly going to be a, you know, challenge as we go forward into budget development for next year to, you know, kind of understand some of these follow-on longer-term impacts and sort of think through how do we plan and how do we shape the budget next year to address some of these things. And, you know, there is always possibility that further federal legislation helps with some of those ideas, but it's not, you know, that's not guaranteed. There's nothing, you know, out there that we know is going to come to us. So we sort of have to monitor and understand these impacts as they become more apparent over time.
Mr. Chairman, Andy Josephson, just for a quick comment.
Representative Josephson.
So just for the committees and the listening audience, I had my staff attend the Education Committee meeting, and the university, President Johnson testified that foregone revenue, he believes, is now $35 to $45 million due to three components. Number one, issues with investment losses. Number two, potential declines in tuition fees and auxiliary income. And number three, research revenue if research is delayed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Seininger?
Yes, are there any further questions on slide 13?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, one quick question.
Representative Lamont.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Regarding grants directly to students, are there limitations on how those monies can be spent by the students, or could it include, for example, travel home?
Through the chair, Representative Lebon, I don't know the answer to that question. I think we might have someone from the university who might be able to answer that.
Lisa, can you hear me?
Yes, if you can put yourself on the record.
Sure. This is Alicia Krakenberg. I'm the Director of Strategy Planning and Budget at the System Office. And I am, quickly reading through. I know there were some limitations. I don't believe here. Hang on one second. So can be used for emergency grants to students, but not for the institution to recoup funds. So if we paid for the students to travel back home, we can't reimburse ourselves for that, but I believe that is an allowable expense for the students. And if I'm incorrect in that, I will get that information to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Senator.
Yes. Moving to slide 14, the National Endowment of the Arts has issued a grant as part of the CARES Act for about $400,000 that goes to the Alaska State Council on the Arts. And so this is to be used to make grants to art organizations and local art agencies to sustain operations through COVID-19.
Please continue.
On slide 15, there's $49 million associated with Federal Aviation Administration Rural Airport System Maintenance. So this is an allocation that is part of a larger piece from the FAA that goes to all owner-operators of airports throughout the country. $49 million of that goes towards rural airports throughout Alaska, which are operated by the Department of Transportation. This money then can be used for general operating and maintenance expenditures in the airports and at those airstrips that are throughout Alaska. And so these are the, you know, non-international airports, rural airports that are managed by the Department of Transportation.
And please continue.
And on slide 16 is $32.1 million of that same FAA allocation, but the portion that goes to the international airports. You'll see there is no then spent by the international airports on general airport expenditures.
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Senator Wolf.
Sure. Merrill Field in Anchorage, it's not a international airport. It's not a rural airport. I've read somewhere they're getting, I want to say, $13 million, and I may be corrected on that. But how would that fall into this?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, so Merrill Airport is also part of the wider FAA distribution, but the Department of Transportation is not the owner-operator for that field. My understanding that they're not the owner-operator for that field, so it wouldn't be part of the money flowing through Department of Transportation.
Representative Wolf, do you have a follow-up on that?
No, I just heard they were getting quite a bit more money. Oh.
Mr. Steininger?
Mr. Chairman, quick question, follow-up.
Sure, Representative LeBron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A follow-up to the question by Representative Wolf. The Merrill Field allocation looks like it's close to $18 million, and I know there's two different buckets of money involved here, but it hardly passes the red face test that the Fairbanks International Airport allocation is $5.7 million, where the Merrill Field allocation is nearly $18 million. I guess that's more common, unless you care to comment on that, Mr. Steininger.
Through the chair, Representative LeBron, I think the only comment I would make is that those allocations were made by the FAA and aren't a matter that's of discretion for the state. What we have discretion over is how we spend the amount of money that was allocated to state-operated airports, so those rural airports and then the international airports that we operate as a state. The individual allocations to those airports were calculated by the FAA and not the state. But then once we have that money within those owner-operators, we can then allocate to the projects that we see fit. So we... within that bucket of rural airports, we don't have to spend exactly as it was allocated by the FAA, but that is the calculation that determined how much the state received, if that makes sense.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And please
slide 17. There's $29 million in Federal Transit Administration grants. So this money is going to the Department of Transportation for eligible operating expenses for Federal Transit Administration 5311 recipients. So these are non-urbanized areas, including Anchorage, Fairbanks. It also includes the Alaska Marine Highway System. So the department is looking at exactly how to distribute this money, and about $10 million of it, I believe, goes to the Marine Highway System, with the rest going to other surface transportation costs.
Okay, and hearing no questions, Mr. Steininger,
okay. On to slide 18. This is another direct grant out of the CARES Act of $3 million that goes to measurement standards and Whittier Tunnel support. So it's being managed through the Department of Transportation, and for unbudgeted and unanticipated expenditures relating to operations and program delivery of measurement standards in the Whittier Tunnel.
And next page, Mr. Steininger.
Okay. Slide 19. This is $3.6 million going to the Department of Public Safety for the BRIN-JAG grant. So this supports quite a few different program areas, law enforcement, prosecution, defense, courts, corrections, crime victims and witness initiatives, and other mental health programs. The grant is direct from the feds to the Department of Public Safety to then be used for those types of purposes.
And next page.
On slide 20, there's $3 million that's coming in to the Department of Elections, so this money will be deposited into the election fund. So right now there is adequate authority to to deposit federal revenues into the election fund. However, the election fund is not subject to the RPL process, so the ability to spend these funds can't be accessed through the RPL process. However, there is an existing project of $3.7 million out of the election fund, which can be used for some of these election security measures and other election costs that the Division of Elections will run into in responding to the crisis.
Mr. Chairman, Andy Josephson.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Mr. Steininger, I think we gave authority in, I'm going to guess it was Senate Bill 241 for the Lieutenant Governor to move to an all-mail ballot, but I'm not sure it covered the general election in November. Dr. Fauci has indicated a virtual guarantee that there will be a second wave of the virus this fall. Is it your understanding, Mr. Steininger, that those monies could be used perhaps to an all-mail ballot in the fall to keep people safe and participating in the democracy?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I don't know the specific criteria around the expenditure of the election funds and exactly what they can and can't be used for. And I think I would defer that question to the Division of Elections.
Thank you.
Anything further on this, Mr. Steininger?
So on to slide 21 is the conclusion of my presentation. If you have any questions on any of the other items or any of the items I've gone over, I can take those now.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I do.
Representative Josephson?
Yes, and I want to preface this by, I don't mean this to be a sort of a gotcha kind of question in the slightest, because I want to preface it by saying I personally, as a citizen, have been very pleased with the administration's work during this crisis. I think they've handled things quite well. However, the administration, and I have the vetoes in front of me, issued $260 million of vetoes, and it believed, and I understand that facts have changed and that happens to everyone, but it believed that most of the vetoes could be supplanted by these dollars. And my question is, does the Office of Management and Budget have an opinion now after the latest guidance about which items can almost surely be supplanted and which cannot?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, if at the time of the vetoes we had a different amount of understanding and guidance on how the CRF funding through the CARES Act could be spent, what we're trying to do is to ensure that communities have as much flexibility as possible within that guidance to make expenditures on anything related to that, to ensure that their normal resources can be used to cover normal non-COVID-related costs that they incur. There are some areas where there are not dollar-for-dollar replacements of the vetoes, but there are resources going to communities to ensure that they can cover COVID-related costs, everything within the bounds of the federal guidance, so that they can preserve their own limited resources to cover other costs of government that may not fit within that federal guidance. So it is our goal to make sure that communities come out of this crisis whole, but there's also the very real issue of the availability of financial resources at all levels of government in Alaska, and so whether we can afford to cover those costs at the state level is also in question.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
There's almost a sense or an inference there, Mr. Steininger, through the chair, that because of the changed circumstances, that as awkward as it may be, that some items should be overridden, and the administration may even sort of see it that way, or that there should be further appropriations. And I ask this, for example, because, Mr. Steininger, you've just said that local government should be made whole. Well, how would we do that unless we provided community assistance for school bond debt reimbursement, as just one example?
So through the chair, Representative Josephson, I'm saying that local communities need to be made whole for costs related to COVID, and that's what the CARES Act is allowing us to do, to ensure that any cost related to COVID is covered and that municipalities aren't harmed by the costs they're incurring to respond to the crisis. And it's our hope that by providing them the maximum flexibility in their use of the CARES Act money, that we can, you know, to the maximum extent possible, hold them harmless for costs related to COVID so that they can preserve other resources that they have to cover other non-COVID-related costs of governance and ensure that the community is not harmed due to COVID.
All right. I'm not fully satisfied with that, but I want to be cooperative. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do we have any further questions or comments?
Yes, I have a question.
Chairman, this is
Go ahead.
Kathy Tilton.
Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Steininger, is there any guidance or guidelines on a lot of these items or grants that are being granted out? And is there any guidance regarding administrative costs on these, or is that allowed at all, or is there any kind of guidance on that? And then I have some other questions after that.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Tilton, in terms of administrative costs of like grantees receiving, say, some of these human services grants, my understanding at this point is that would be allowable insofar as their administrative costs related to the direct costs from COVID. So if a grantee has, you know, established administrative cost structure, percentage that they normally would charge to administrative costs on a grant, that would be an acceptable route to go down. That's my understanding at this point. There really hasn't been much direct guidance on that very specific question. But my understanding, based on the, you know, the guidance that we have and what the, you know, the Treasury released on the 22nd, it seems that, you know, the cost of administration related to providing these types of services, you know, would be an allowable thing.
Thank you. And then regarding the life of the federal dollars, if the federal dollars are not spent and then they lapse back to the Fed, and if so, and if this happens, is it on a federal fiscal year, or are there some other lapse date or terms? I mean, most likely most of the dollars will be used, but in the unlikely event that they are not, I'm just wondering about the date and how that would be handled.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Tilton. So the guidance currently limits expenditures through the end of December. So, you know, if the funds aren't expended by that point, then they would be returned. You know, my understanding is that it would follow a normal sort of accounting process where if it's encumbered at that point, that it probably wouldn't need to be reimbursed, but we don't have necessarily specific detail on that or on what the date that, you know, a final audit of the expenditures would occur. You know, it'll be sometime after that December 30th timeline.
And so follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Steininger, for all of your answers today and for this presentation. On the note, should there be like a community that has funds and that do lapse, is it the responsibility then of the state to be sure that those dollars get back to the federal government, or is it the responsibility of the community?
Through the chair, Representative Tilton, you know, that's a good portion of why we are, you know, requiring that reporting coming back, so that if we start to see a situation like that develop, we can, you know, determine what the best logistics are. You know, since money was distributed to directly to the state from the Treasury, you know, my expectation is that the federal government would expect us to return it. So we'd have to work with that community to ensure that, you know, we set up those mechanisms. And so that monthly reporting will give us, you know, visibility into where those issues might arise.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Okay. Do we have any further questions?
Chair?
I do, Mr. Chairman.
I think I heard Representative Woolley and Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Steininger, you mentioned that municipalities and trying to keep them whole as effects from COVID, and you had economic metrics involved in your distribution to municipalities based on maybe tourism dollars or fishing dollars. But I think in my community in Fairbanks, that may not top the list on tourism or fishing, but the university is a big part of our economic profile or portfolio here. And the university has stated they could be affected to the tune of $30 or $40 million. They're in the $5 million grant, of which they get 7.9, half of it goes to students. So they get about $4 million there. And maybe in the K-12 funds, they get a little bit of that. So it looks like they're going to be severely affected, and they do affect the municipalities that they're located in. So I just didn't. There seems to be a little disconnect as far as helping out the municipalities, and our municipality has a large entity that will be heavily affected, and it seems like the funds going towards higher education are diminutive as compared to those going to, say, the municipalities or to the $100 million to the fishing industry. So I'm not trying to take away from those other entities, because I believe they need it as well, but I'd like to see maybe a little more effort towards the higher education component. Also, they were vetoed by $10 million in the operating budget as well. So I just didn't know if there's further plans to address this.
Through the chair, Representative Wool, I think we need to continue to work with the, you know, university as we go forward into budget development in, you know, for future years as we see some of the impacts of COVID, you know, affect them. And you're right in that I don't believe that the university was part of those, you know, economic activity metrics, but we were working with what information was available to us at that point. You know, the existing amount, the $7.9 million, is the amount that was allocated by the federal government through the CARES Act to higher education institutions, and so that's, you know, that was limited by the, you know, decisions at the federal level and not necessarily state decisions. But I definitely, you know, in sympathetic to the concerns that we ensure that, you know, communities are, you know, that see some of these outweighed impacts are assisted through our distribution of funds, and that we're, you know, that we're taking into consideration all of these, you know, various second order impacts. And it can be hard to ensure that every little area that has an impact is being addressed. But we feel confident that there's a, you know, fairly broad distribution within this plan to try and hit as many areas as we possibly can.
Okay, thank you. I just know in future years of funding is fine, but come this September, I think there'll be effects felt immediately. So, I know there's other funds besides the Higher Education Emergency Relief Fund that the state has access to. So, I hope you'll consider that. Thank you.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and again, thank you, Mr. Steininger, for being with us today and for your answers that you provided us. My question is going back to slide 5 and whether or not, you know, because slide 5 talks about approximately $305 million going directly to municipalities aid assistance, is it the position of the administration that the RPL process is the correct process based on the fact that there is no federal funding within the current budget that's a part of municipality aid, and so therefore is the RPL method the method that we should be using to appropriate these funds? Because it seems to be it's a different category of funding than what currently exists under the category of federal funding.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Ortiz, we believe the RPL process is the the correct process to use in this situation. That process, the RPLs through the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, is designed for situations where after a budget has passed, we have an increase or new federal receipts coming into the state. That's the situation that we find ourselves in now. And so we're using the mechanisms that exist in order to get access to the federal relief dollars.
As a follow-up then, Mr. Chairman?
A follow-up?
But isn't that creating a new category of federal funding? It's not one that currently exists. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I assume by new category you mean that this is a new type of federal grant that that this state agency hadn't received in the past. Assuming that that's the question, that is something that's done under the RPL process in the past. For example, Department of Education recently received a new grant for literacy development that we accessed through the RPL process. That was a entirely new program for the department that hadn't, it was a new grant they had never received before, or a new category of federal spending, if you will. And so, it's not necessarily uncommon to use the RPL process for, new federal grants that haven't existed before, that kind of, come to the state, unanticipatedly. This is simply just a much larger dollar value than we're used to seeing, but it is, within the bounds of things that we have done before through the RPL process. So, when we're looking at what our options to get access to federal revenue are when there's not, an active appropriation bill and the legislature is not, actively meeting in session, the RPL process is the most expeditious means that we have available, and it we feel it fits the criteria, for access to these federal funds.
And, Mr. Chairman, just one last follow-up, and again, this is not intended to be a debate, so I appreciate your answers, Mr. Steiniger, but you spoke about when we're not in session. Isn't it been common practice that when we're in the interim period where the RPL process has been used and we're not in the interim period? Isn't that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, that is a good point, but that's not, there's no specific prohibition on that. And so we were looking for what are the processes that we have available to access these federal funds, which process allows us to access these federal funds in an expeditious manner, since these are, intended to cover costs that were incurred on March 1st and forward. So we're getting to, those costs having been borne for 2 months without being able to provide relief to communities to cover those costs that they're currently incurring. So, an expeditious mechanism is very important. The LBNA process and some main RPLs, is a process that's available that is intended to access new federal revenues that come in. And so, we feel that's the appropriate mechanism to get access to these funds and to get this distribution made as quick as possible.
And I promise last follow-up, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Steiniger, do you have a legal opinion on the validity of the RPL process being used here?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I'm basing this off of, prior RPLs that we've submitted for, new revenues coming in, revenues that maybe had never been appropriated to a specific appropriation before, or new programs that had never really been considered before, such as that education example I used. So it's more based on past practice. I don't have a an opinion in my hand.
Thank you. Thank you for that, Mr. Steininger. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Feldman-Leonard.
Yes, thank you, sir. Mr. Steininger, I just wanted to say thank you for your diligence here in answering all these questions. Mine is with relation to page 6 regarding ADA funding, and my concern are, if you will, the mom-and-pop small businesses that may or may not have employees, but they've kind of fallen through the cracks with regard to getting support from the PPP or even through the SBA loans. Can you tell me how some of these ADA grants may be dispersed to help some of these smaller mom-and-pop businesses?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Sullivan-Leonard, that's a really good point. The reason that we had structured this RPL the way we did to touch on multiple state agencies is because there are, you know, different levels of businesses in the state, and some of the mom-and-pops probably don't interact with the Industrial Development Authority in the way that they might interact with other areas within Commerce, the Department of Commerce. And really, we're looking at this to be available to those entities and those businesses that don't have the ability to get support through the payment protection or the Small Business Administration loans, you know, those who maybe have been rejected for those loans or, you know, just aren't, you know, don't have access to them otherwise. You know, so we are very sensitive to those small mom and pops that are going to need the relief, you know, almost more than anyone else.
Thank you. That's fantastic. I appreciate hearing that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, follow-up to that, please.
Sure, Representative LeBron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A follow-up to Representative Sullivan-Leonard's concern, and I share that, the best way to take care of the smaller mom-and-pop businesses is through their local banks. The local banks know who they are and what their needs are. ADA and AHFC are not directly connected to the smaller businesses. So, again, I'm repeating myself, but I urge the administration to work with the banks as part of this solution and do some kind of an allocation program to make sure that the smaller banks are also able to participate. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions or comments? Hearing none, we'll go to Chair Johnson for some closing comments and then adjourn out. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Steininger. You've done an amazing amount of work here and truly appreciate it. I also appreciate how candid you are as far as some of these RPLs being a work in progress. I, too, have spent time poring over the guidance, and as I keep saying, sometimes it's as clear as mud. But I do, there's a couple of things that I've highlighted, and one is, on the first page, it says funds may not be used to fill shortfalls in government revenue to cover expenditures that would not otherwise qualify under the statute. And although a broad range of use is allowed, revenue replacement is not permissible use of funds. I think that's one thing that we need to keep in the back of our head and keep actually front and center as we're looking at this. They also have a non-exclusive examples of ineligible expenditures, and a lot of them are what you would expect, expenses for state share of Medicaid, damage covered by insurance, payroll or benefits, expenses for employees whose duties do not substantially dedicated to the mitigating use or the responding to a COVID-19 public health emergency, expenses that have been or will be reimbursed by other federal programs, such as reimbursements from other parts of the CARES Act, reimbursements to donors for donated items or service, workforce bonuses under then hazard pay or overtime, severance pay, and legal settlements. And I have to say, number 8, legal settlements is something I think we need to be quite aware of. I think one thing that we can take away from the federal government, is transparency is going to be our friend here. And so I think as transparent as possible we are in any of these formulas will probably help us instead of hurt us. And I appreciate your efforts so far in that, Mr. Steininger. The one other thing, if you go to the webpage on Treasuries, there's frequently asked questions. And one is, may a state receiving a payment transfer funds to local government? And yes, we can. Such funds would be subject to recoupment by the Treasury if they have not been used in a manner consistent with this act. And so we have not only a liability with the funds that we are dealing with to local communities, we have liability in the funds that we are going to somehow appropriate the state. And as I say, I think transparency, I think cooperation between the legislature and the administration is very, very important. I think we need to get these funds out as soon as possible, but we also need to be aware that we actually have a huge liability in how we get them out, and we need to be very transparent. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnston. Mr. Steininger, I'd also like to thank you for providing us with a great deal of information. And do you have anything in closing, Mr. Steininger?
Thank you for the opportunity to come and present these and explain more detail behind, you know, what this plan is and, you know, how we intend to provide this relief. I know it's like Co-Chair Johnston said, it's sometimes like, you know, the guidance gets muddier and muddier, but I think as we look at, you know, the guidance coming out from the feds and we make sure that we tailor our response and our plan to that guidance and that we, you know, really make sure that, you know, the funds are available to those most connected to the response, I think we'll be more successful in getting through this. But thank you for the time. Thank you for the opportunity.
Great. Thank you. And with that, we will be adjourned at 12:12 p.m. Thank you, everyone.